Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, an accelerating telecoms fraud crisis in the country, 5 billion rand in annual losses, now triggering an urgent national response. Game on for education, e-sports enters the South African classroom. The rise of South Africa's roadside convenience hubs and why shell properties are turning heads in real estate. It's Wednesday, the 23rd of July. Now, South Africa is hemorrhaging over 5 billion rand a year to telecom fraud, and that's just the start. SIM swap attacks now account for around 60% of mobile banking breaches. The Communication Risk Information Centre, or COMRIC, has released its 2025 sector report, and it's warning of a crime wave that is crippling infrastructure, undermining digital trust, and also threatening national security. But the organisation says we're not powerless if we act now. So let's talk a little further about that. COMRIC Chief Executive Officer, Advocate Tokozani Mvelasi, a very warm welcome to you. 5.3 billion rand in losses. That's a lot of money. How did we get there?
Jeremy, thank you so much for inviting me into your show. So the 5.3 billion is a combination of the various types of digital fraud events. Like you just stated in your introduction, the 60% link to SIMSWAP. SIMSWAP is amongst the others that contribute to that 60% banking fraud issues. But we also have subscription fraud instances where we, as network operators, we are under siege by organized crimes who go to our stores and purchase services with all fraudulent information that you can find in this country. And we are unable to detect them in most cases. But also we have instances where SIM box machines are used to bypass pay charges that network to network are charged. So it's a combination of the various digital fraud. And also we have scams that are linked to these types of events, where these digital scams lead to someone losing their money or financial asset. So it is a combination of various digital fraud links that we have.
Let's go to the mobile banking breaches and that figure of 60%, if we can, stemming, as you say, from SIM swaps. Who's failing us here? Is it the banks or the networks?
I don't think there's the issue of someone failing who. It's just that the criminals have managed to bypass various authentication that between the banks and the mobile operators exist. Criminals are using the evolution of technology to bypass the various security features that we have. From our side as network operators, we do quite a lot of verification checks before we can process a SIM swap. In our report, we even indicated that in a quarter, we process almost about 3,600 SIM swap requests. Out of that, only 3% accounts to SIM swap fraud. However, from the banking point of view, where someone is in charge, you are in charge of your banking app. The question is whether, what are the authentications that you need to go through for someone to even access that? So it's really not that as the network operators are failing the society or the banks, the criminals have managed to bypass and are doing that. But we have reduced this over a period of time. Actually, there was a time SIMSWAP was the biggest problem that as the network operators were suffering from, but we have really reduced the search. Because also we act on a conflict. We have to always keep people connected. So when we receive that SIM swap request, we have to do our best to make sure that Jeremy is always connected. But we don't do it without verifying quite a number of information to make sure that the person who does the SIM swap is the legitimate user of that mobile device or that number.
There's no doubt it is a crisis, and in that respect, is either government regulation too slow or law enforcement not adequate to deal with the problem?
Yeah, I think from a law enforcement point of view, the enforcement is really needed. But also from the regulatory point of view, we need to start looking in terms of the evolution of digital fraud, but also the evolution of technology that enables crime to change its pattern, and whether our regulatory landscape is up to date. It's like every time when I even make mention of the issues of the OTT, which is your over the top layers like your WhatsApps, your Instagram, where now you can even make calls undetected using those applications. In this country, those are not regulated, but they operate on our infrastructure. So you have those issues where also the regulator needs to act with speed. From a law enforcement point of view, it's sometimes the challenges of understanding the telco crime. And that's why, as the network operators, we've raised our hand to partner with law enforcement to help them understand the types of crime that we're dealing with, because that's the challenge as well. We need to bridge the gap, Jeremy.
The danger, of course, is that you highlight progress, but are we getting better at reporting it, but perhaps not preventing it quick enough?
I think we're getting better on both. It's what is lacking, which we have identified, is that we need to do more on creating the awareness, actually, because if we look at the statistics of some of the targeted victims, it could either be the elderly, the illiterate, but also people that are in areas where probably the communication that is made doesn't reach them. So we need to do better. And it's not only that the telecoms industry. We are also talking to the financial services that probably we need to join efforts in these awareness that we need to do, because if we do the awareness, that's your better prevention. We can use our own analytics to do some detection, but if we don't prevent it from the root cause, which I think awareness, we go a long mile to make sure that we get to the prevention stage, and we need to do more on that. That's my call.
So a final question then, failure to act decisively, I imagine, in the next 12 to 18 months is going to cost the country a lot of money. What's the big call to action here in terms of a unified approach or plan?
Where Combrig is, one thing that we're really asking for is that there need to be collaboration not only within the telco universe, but we need to also have more cross-sector collaboration and be able to share various intelligence and case studies so that we can work closely enough in terms of preventing some of this. But also what is critical as well, we need to make sure that we work with our legislators to make sure that they enable the processes for us to be able to be even exchange threat intelligence that various sectors might have, or also that various member operators that might have. If we can enable the legislation that it makes it easier for crime prevention initiatives, we can collaborate even better, because I think the fear of collaboration is also constrained with regulation that have to do with competition laws or POPIA and so forth. And we need to find a way how we navigate that, but still complying with some of those legislations.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that figure is staggering. South Africa losing something in the region of 5 billion rand a year to telecoms fraud. Advocate Tokozani Mvelase, thank you very much indeed. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the Communication Risk Information Centre.
Airbus Company South Africa welcomes you to our International Airport.
At the end of November, Johannesburg will host the first G20 summit on African soil, and the world is watching. Mandates and Megaphones is a new MoneyWeb podcast hosted by me, Jeremy Maggs, unpacking the politics, promises, and the power plays behind this historic event. From debt diplomacy and climate justice to global trade tensions, infrastructure pressure, and who gets a seat at the table, I'm going to dig into the issues that really matter and the impact on business and the economy. Follow Mandates and Megaphones on MoneyWeb and wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by Standard Bank.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, as term three kicks off, many parents might be asking this question: is my child spending too much time gaming? But what if those hours weren't just screen time, but were possibly a launchpad to future careers and sharper minds? At Curro schools across the country, esports isn't a distraction anymore. I'm told it's part of the classroom. So I want to explore this in a little more detail with Magdalene de Kock, who's Curro's esports project manager. And maybe let's see how gaming is being redefined as education. So Magdalene, a very warm welcome. And let me start with the obvious. Esport in schools, is it really education or just glorified playtime?
No, esports is definitely one of those tools that a teacher has at their fingertips that will just enhance what you are doing in the classroom. Esports isn't there to replace traditional learning. It is there to enhance it, where we use structured programs to teach teamwork, leadership, problem solving, and even post-match reflections that increase their performance and help them think critically and develop some resilience.
Parents, I think it's fair to say, might listen to our conversation and worry about screen addiction, though. Are we not just fueling that by formalizing gaming?
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. I think we need to think about gaming as nurturing talent and helping preparing our learners and our children for future careers in tech and media. We are living in an AI-driven world, and learners are playing games whether we like it or not. So we need to make sure that we harness those challenges and utilize the tools at our disposal to help guide them.
So could you make the link for me then between learning as you're doing in the classroom using e-gaming and eventual career choice and the benefit that's going to have to younger people down the line?
Well, the first part of that is we try to, at Curro, we really focus on this holistic approach where we balance school, academics, culture, sport. And through all of these various programs, it's all about strategic thinking, collaboration, persistence, and helping learners be better communicators, kinder humans, because that is what we are looking to. And those are the skills that we can teach through games, through esports, through game-based learning that you cannot teach a computer or an AI. Those are the skills that a learner will need to function in the future with technology going places that we do not know. We need to prepare learners for those jobs that don't exist yet. And through playing games, through developing their technical skills, making sure they are well-balanced, rounded adults eventually, but also digital citizens and digitally equipped to function in this world that's waiting for them.
Now, Magdalene, I'm of the generation where playing games meant playing outside, but what I am intrigued about is the importance of strategic thinking, because it's something that every economy needs. Make the link then between something like Minecraft and strategic thinking.
Well, it really develops transferable skills. Because when you are in a world and you need to function there, communicate and work with your team to solve problems, specifically using Minecraft as an example, we are currently running a grade 7 game-based learning task where the learners are immersed in a world learning about power, the different types of energy, as well as population, and how energy needs will differ depending on the size of your population growth. So being involved deeply in this game, working in the game, playing the game, solving problems inside the game in a realistic environment where they are immersed completely, that is not possible for them in the real world. That gives them a different perspective on what we used to say is content. Content-driven teaching has come and gone. We need to focus now on getting learners actively involved, building their own thinking skills within these gaming aspects that we are involving in the classroom.
And what success have you had in measuring academic impact? Is there data to back up the benefits that you're outlining?
Well, interesting you are asking that. We are actually currently busy with a program because after a couple of years, we started esports in 2020. So now we can actually start measuring this 4 years later. We are currently compiling all of the data for our learners to track academic growth, specifically in our sciences subjects, math, life sciences, taking a learner's journey from before they started playing esports through their next 3-4 years, see, looking at their academic progress. But beyond that, we are also seeing learners taking on percentages and rankings in games. In 2024, we had a learner in the top 7% of Apex Legends players globally. Now, taking into account that that is about 100 million Apex Legends players throughout the world, and if you are ranked in the top 7%, means you are in the top 100,000 players, the amount of strategy behind your thinking and looking angles, math and angles in first-person shooter games are absolutely incredible. It's beyond what these learners can do in these games these days.
And just finally, and I'm sure you've got a very good counter argument here, but I'd suggest this is maybe just for privileged schools, and it's going to be difficult for less resourced institutions to even begin to compete.
Oh, definitely not. I can definitely counter that one, where apps like Minecraft Education, you can use those lessons. There's multiple lessons available for all schools to use, all teachers, that is through their websites, where globally there are teachers building lessons that you can use for free as part of that app. And also using games like Brawlhalla, for example, that is a mobile app, and you can play it on your phone. You don't need the most amazing esports equipment to be able to participate in esports at school.
Well, that certainly is a glimpse into the future of education, which seems to have arrived right now. Magdalene de Kock, thank you very much indeed. Curo Esports Project Manager, I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, forecourts are changing fast. With fuel no longer necessarily the main draw card, South Africa's service stations are pushing hard into food, loyalty programs, and quick service retail. The new Trade Intelligence Forecourt Retail Report breaks it all down, and I want to discuss this in a little more detail with Andrea Slubber. And let's see what's driving this reinvention, and perhaps more importantly, whether it's working. So, Andrea, a very warm welcome to you. The main pressures driving forecourt retailers to diversify beyond fuel sales, what are they? What are you seeing?
So a few considerations. I mean, the rise of the convenience trend, shoppers have really embraced convenience retail. So that is important at the moment for fuel retailers, because fuel volumes locally and globally are declining. So the fuel stations are becoming more reliant on the forecourt retail offering to bring in money. And an interesting stat from the US says that although the forecourt convenience only brings in about 30 to 40% of sales, it contributes about 60% to gross profit. So obviously there's potential, although the total revenue from the forecourt retail is relatively lower than from fuel, there's potential for growth.
But it's interesting, in economic terms, as you say, fuel volumes are down, but if forecourt numbers are up, isn't that a recipe potentially for oversupply?
Sure, that is a big consideration, especially in South Africa. If you have a look at the total FMCG or grocery retail landscape, the footprint of convenience stores have certainly expanded. But like I said, if you look from a shopper-centric perspective, South African shoppers love convenience shopping. That said, if we look at the growth over the past year, the forecourt channel as a whole from a retail perspective only grew at about 4% in revenue, compared to total retail in FMCG growing at about 6.9%. And if we double-click on other channels growing faster, discounters, for example, grew at 13%, and e-commerce obviously grows way faster than that. But it's becoming a very contested area of retail, especially for the big retailers, expanding their influence and their formats within this channel.
And Andrea, who of us on the way home haven't stopped at the Woolies at NGEN? I absolutely get that, and I understand why you say that convenience shopping is important to South Africans, but convenience shopping also comes often at a price premium. We don't seem to mind that, obviously.
Yes, I mean, we did some shopper research that showed exactly that. Shoppers acknowledge that they are likely to pay a premium, but for the convenience, it's a good trade-off for them. Also, I mean, the forecourt retailers understand they're in competition with the mainstream convenience stores and supermarkets. I mean, many supermarkets are now extending their opening hours. So where forecourt convenience gave you that advantage of later hours being open, within that later slot, many supermarkets and convenience stores are also offering that now. So they too have to compete for shopper foot traffic. And obviously they have ramped up convenience sort of discount deals on food offers, etc. Bundle deals, you know, these snack and drink combo deals proving to be very popular. And shoppers are expecting to see discounts and deals at forecourts.
Yeah, not always good for the waistline, but that's a different conversation entirely. Yeah. Andrea, I think I know the answer to this, but tell me anyway, how important are supermarket partnerships in terms of fuel-branded partnerships? In other words, the supermarket-branded forecourt seems to have more currency.
Yes. So the stats show us that there's more growth from those forecourt retail stores that have the supermarket partnerships. And I think, you know, the supermarkets have established themselves as almost lifestyle partners to South African consumers and shoppers. And certainly there's been, I think, like a 26% increase in these partnerships between supermarkets and fuel stations over the past year. So definitely, I mean, if shoppers are loyal to a particular retailer, which while I say it, I know it's not even true because people shop around, but certainly knowing the quality standards of those retailers, it draws them into the stores. You mentioned the Woolies Food Stops. I mean, the introduction of the After Dark partnership with on-demand delivery has just worked really well. We hear that they talk about a 15 to 20% incremental growth from those stores. And certainly, I mean, shoppers love their offering at those stores.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's crazy. I mean, who really needs an egg salad sandwich at 11:30 at night? But let me not judge,
You'll
Andrea.
Be surprised.
I'm sure I would be. This is interesting. You talk about a short in-store dwell time, and you've, in fact, calculated it at 3.5 minutes. It's going to be difficult for forecourts to boost basket size, surely.
It is, but the levers that they are engaging with is, for example, those bundle deals that are advertised. And I mean, many of these forecourts, especially associated with retailers that have a good following on social media, know how to get good news out fast. Surprisingly, also, we've seen an uptick in sales of what we would regard as premium snacks that are also in bundle deals. And we know that not all people that visit a forecourt convenience outlet are there to fill up for fuel. So often they go there for particular items. And surprisingly, sometimes there are highly competitive deals on some convenience snacks there.
Let me pivot slightly. Loyalty programs are also booming in the space. Tell me why, and do you think they are really moving the needle when it comes to traffic and spend?
I think it's more of a hygiene factor or a passport factor rather than moving the needle. If you look at shopper perception of loyalty, you'll ask shoppers, are they loyal to a particular store or brand? And they'll say yes. But from a store perspective, if you ask them how many loyalty cards do they have across different retailer stores, you'll also be surprised to see they're actually loyal to all of them. So the fuel retailers understand that it's not really about building a loyalty club. It's really shouting out, we have rewards or discount offers for you. And without that, you're not going to see a good foot traffic and following from South African shoppers, because we've been spoiled for choice in terms of loyalty rewards. So when we talk loyalty in the South African shopper's mind, it's more about what's in it for them. That means discounts and reward points towards discounts.
I wonder, as we have this conversation, what might be missing from the mix. So we've seen KFC, there are bespoke coffee counters. I've even seen parcel lockers, all obviously adding some kind of value when it comes to driving growth. But what's missing, do you think, or what's likely to come?
So electric vehicles and charging stations, the whole shift hasn't hit South Africa. Obviously, we're lagging behind some other first world countries, but that is going to revolutionize the whole forecourt store experience and mission. What are you doing there? How long will you spend there? I mean, we hear about the long charging times and lots of concepts being developed in terms of what people will do with their time and the opportunities to sort of also, shall I say, extract revenue while giving the customers what they want and need. But it's early days to speculate about that in South Africa specifically. But they are definitely looking at lifestyle hubs around these charging stations. And early days, way too early for South Africa.
And as we conclude this conversation, Andrea Slabbe, I feel a Coke and a pie coming on as I wend my way home. Thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
While much of the property conversation still focuses on vacant land and off-plan developments, a growing number of investors and home buyers are turning to something in between, something called shell properties. My understanding, partially built homes, structurally complete but unfinished inside, and offers a middle ground between raw land and, I guess, a turnkey house. And supporters say shell homes offer cost control, fewer risks and greater customization. But are they a truly better investment than buying land from scratch? Well, let's put that to the test. I'm in conversation now with Bardo van der Merwe, who's Managing Director at Renishaw Property Developments. And let's discuss the pros and cons of this emerging trend and what buyers need to know before signing on. So Bardo, welcome. And for someone hearing this for the first time, give me your best definition of a shell property and how it's different from vacant land or a fully built home.
Yes, a shell home is a home where the structure is complete. So the walls, the roof, doors and windows are all complete. And often the developer would also install the garden. But they would stop short from installing any of the services like the floors, tiles, the cupboards or even the sanitaryware.
Now, your contention is that investors are increasingly opting for shells over raw land. So why is that? What's driving this shift in buyer behavior?
We believe that the visual clarity of the design is probably the biggest factor. And what I mean with that is the buyer can walk into the structure and experience the structure for what it's going to be. You can look through the windows, you can see the views, and you can experience the space. Whereas when you buy a house or plan, you clearly need to visualize that. And often you do not know what the buildings around your house is going to be like. Will you have the view that you currently have of the ocean, or will you be looking into your neighbor's property?
There would, I imagine, Bartow, be a degree of risk. Maybe shell homes come with fewer surprises than land, I think is your suggestion. So could you break down what some of those hidden risks of raw land actually are compared to the shell?
Yeah, sure. You know, investing in land, especially when you invest in a new development, in a new neighborhood, that carries quite a bit of risk, especially in terms of the developer's financial stability and his ability to complete the project, as well as, you know, what the future is going to be looking like in 5 years from now. Whereas if you buy into an established estate where all the services have been installed, I mean, all the utilities like water and sanitation and reliable electricity, that all those risks are obviously not there.
From a cost perspective, is buying a shell property cheaper in the long run, or the flexibility to customize, which is maybe attractive on the one hand, maybe could lead to overspending in the long term?
I don't think it's necessarily more cost effective to buy it, but there's definitely unforeseen risks associated with buying a vacant land. First of all is rates and taxes, something that must not be overlooked. Some municipalities charge quite high rates on vacant land, so this is something to be considered. Secondly is security costs, you know, security fencing or other security monitoring costs, and that is obviously to prevent illegal dumping or illegal occupation. And that is, of course, a serious risk. Once an illegal structure has been erected and the roof is up, it becomes very difficult to evict such a person.
You also mention that banks are more willing to finance shell homes than bare land. Why is that, and how does it affect access for ordinary buyers?
The point is really that it's more difficult to loan against a vacant land. Banks don't often use land as security to leverage future projects.
And one benefit you highlight is avoiding construction headache. But there would be problems, surely, if buyers run into delays or poor contractors when finishing the interior themselves. So how do they avoid that? And who carries the risk once the shell is handed over?
When you buy a shell home, I would suggest that buyers buy a shell home from a developer that is reputable and would be able to complete the project. I would not recommend buying a shell house as is. You would buy a shell house with the intention of the developer completing it, and therefore that would alleviate you from the risk of completing the project yourself, something that I would not recommend to an inexperienced, you know, developers or layman who's not used to construction risk.
And Barta, do shell homes appreciate at the same pace as a completed house, or is there a ceiling until they're fully finished?
I think they wouldn't necessarily increase in value quicker than or slower than a completed house. I think that, you know, the end product is obviously important, and the quality of the build, especially the quality of the finishes, is very important. So make sure that is done properly.
And just finally then, are shell homes only viable in so-called managed estates, or does this also work in standalone urban or rural plots as well?
I don't think it's common practice to buy a shell home as a one-off house that's being developed by a small town developer. I think it would be more advisable to buy a shell home from a reputable developer who is in the process of completing an estate, who has obviously the ability to negotiate better prices from suppliers, and who's, as I said earlier, is reputable and experienced in completing the finishes to the right standards.
Thank you very much indeed, Barto van der Merwe, Managing Director at Renishaw Property Developments. I appreciate your time today. And that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.